start with giving the announcements and the reading of the declaration. We meet here in Philadelphia twice a week on Sunday mornings, as we are now, from 11 to noon. The door is opened at 10:30. And usually there's some sort of discussion in reference to a title that's head for the month. Now here in November, we're doing basic theosophical principles. And today we're going to be doing reincarnation, the doctrine of hope. And then next Sunday will be the potentiality for human perfectibility. Then on Wednesday evenings, we have our study class, and also our reference library is open from 5:15 to 7:15. You're welcome to come in and browse through the books, read the reference for the Wednesday night class. And then the class starts at 7:30 and runs to 8:30. This session, we're reading and working in The Key to Theosophy. Coming up, the next section will be from pages 48 to 56, dealing with the sacredness of a pledge and on self-improvement. So those are the two meetings that we have here to spread broadcast the teachings. We want to read to you the declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. And that work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a true realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teachings, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So, we will now look at our idea for today. This idea of reincarnation is a mystery to minds because they find it a difficulty understanding such a permanency as must stand behind repeated incarnations. They think of themselves as persons, as bodies of a physical nature. And their minds are so identified with the body in its relationship and the surroundings that they are unable to dissociate from that. This is how they think of it as right now. So we wanted to bring up the idea of changing factors. Now, we're all aware that we know the body changes from birth to death, from sleep to waking. There's a changing of the body. And then we know that also we change our minds. We might believe one thing one day, and down the road something comes up, and we no longer believe that. In my mind, I now believe this. So we do know, if we look at the idea of the body and the mind, and also, what about our surroundings? Our surroundings are always changing. And we do know that nothing is real that changes. And we do know also that old adage that change cannot see change. But yet, what is within us that can perceive change? That gives us the idea of that identity, that I that we knew as a young child, as a teenager, as midlife, as older getting, we know I. We're always saying I this, I that. We know that people that have been in accidents and have gone into comas and come out of it, who am I? Where am I? That I is that constant perceiver. And that I that we take for granted is not this outer physical form, this personality, this, shall we say, the mask that they wear in any one lifetimes. So if we keep in mind that there is that constant part of our nature that perceives all changes, this is what we're talking about. When we talk about the idea of the self, we know that the idea of that permanent consciousness through all stages of being is eternal and changeless. That's the self, the real nature within us. And we have been told that the self is its own law. Each one is the self, and each as self has produced the conditions under which he finds himself. This is the idea, so that we know that when self acts, it receives a reaction. And also this idea that if we keep in mind, just in general, it's not so much what we go through that counts, it's what we can learn from it. Because every set stage that we go through, every act and reaction that we go through, is a constant learning, constantly learning and keeping us intact. So it's not so much what we go through that we should think about, it's what we learn from any situation we go through. And the idea, even lightly, is this idea that we're always in the right place at the right time. Briefly, that's karma. That's cause and effect. It is the eternal fitness of things, the balance, the harmony, call it what you may. And we also remember understanding that idea that seeds are never beaten into an unbroken ground, but rather they're sowed in a tilled soil, In other words, the right situation has to be there for it to happen. So now we come around, technically, to the whole purpose of reincarnation. Again, not so much about the mask that we all are aware of right now, but rather it is for the evolution of the soul. It says, for which all alone, all this universe exists, and the raising up of the whole of humanity to the highest possible stage of perfection on an earth of this kind. So it is an inner development we're talking about, not so much an outer. We found a statement from Mr. Judges that we wanted to read exactly to you. The soul that breaks through the illusion of self-identification with mortal forms at the same time of necessity renounces the great heresy of separateness and recognizes its essential identity with all other souls. Then its work begins, which is to labor incessantly for the liberation of its younger brother souls everywhere and from the bondage of conditioned existence. So that idea that history repeats itself is something we can look into, because again, that in a way is the whole makings up of this idea of the purpose of reincarnation, the ringing grooves of change that are constantly going on. It's got to give us some ideas that there's got to be something more than this everyday life that we're living. So maybe there is an aspect that needs to be looked into, and that is the aspect of hope. And now we'll hear about hope.
You know, people think in today's world that reincarnation is a very interesting idea, and they also reckon that it's a law. Well, it isn't. Karma is the law. The law of periodic cycles of action and reaction, rest and activity, a law that we know and use in every aspect of our lives. We depend on certain things, that water will behave the way water does and fire will behave the way fire does. We accept that. We don't bother to investigate that that law works equally on our natures and on our moral nature. What is reincarnation then, if karma is the law? Reincarnation is the process that is used by karma, by law, to allow us to get the results of what we have done. It can't happen all in one life. The fact is that we set up causes, and those causes will have their effect. Something to really be pondered on is, no effect can come without a cause. No cause can ever not have an effect. That means we have to look, each one individually, at our life, at the circumstances and effects that we are experiencing. We cannot necessarily point to the cause, but we can know that it is a law, that what comes to me is mine. What leaves from me will return to me. In other words, as I treat life, as I treat others, I will get the exact treatment back from life. Now, that doesn't sound very hopeful if we're a very negative, mean, or nasty person, but anyone and anything recognizing this power can change, can turn that around, can take control of their own evolution, their own growth, and use their powers of heart and mind in a hopeful way and begin to change. We found an interesting quote from Jane Goodall describing how she was introduced to theosophy during her younger years in London. And in her autobiography, Reason for Hope, A Spiritual Journey, she writes, "I was especially drawn to the concepts of karma and reincarnation because I was still trying very hard to make sense of the horrors of the war. I had never been able to believe that we would be assigned to some kind of hell because we failed during one experience of mortal life. After all, one human lifespan measured against eternity, it has gone faster than a millionth of a second. So the concept of karma and reincarnation made logical sense to me." Well, once we accept the concept, we really have to come up with a plan. Karma is the law of responsibility. Reincarnation is the doctrine of hope. Because we will return and reap the benefits, positive and negative, we can work out a plan for ourselves. We can keep a critical open eye on ourselves and begin to see where we need to learn and to grow. It's a slow labor. And Theosophy tells us we've been here for 18 million years. So we probably have experienced just about everything. We just have not assimilated it. We've not used the knowledge that we have. We're too busy, as was said, leading a personal life, going after expectations and hopes for what we want on this earth, in this personal nature. And yet we have had such brilliant teachers all the way through history. We have the Bhagavad Gita, which is over 5,000 years old, the teachings of Krishna to Arjuna, teaching him how to act in life in order to set up the right causes that lead to knowledge, that lead eventually to wisdom. We have Epictetus. We don't know about the rest of you, but following the quotes of Epictetus on a daily basis is usually very revealing. He said, "We cannot choose our external circumstances." But a student of Theosophy would say, "Aha, but you did. You just don't know when or how, but you did choose them." But we can always choose how we respond to those circumstances. If we remember nothing but that, I always have the choice, no matter what is happening to me, to respond in a better and a higher way. "Nothing truly stops you," says Epictetus. "Nothing holds you back, for your own will is always within your own control. Sickness may challenge your body, but are you merely your body? Lameness may impede your legs, but you are not merely your legs. Your will is bigger than your legs. Your will needn't be affected by any incident unless you let it." And of course, we all know from the writings of Madame Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, Robert Crosby, that we have opportunities at all times. Even if we're alone, if we're thinking about a past memory and it irritates us, we can use that as an opportunity to understand it. Why does it bother me? What was I looking for that didn't happen? What is wrong with my thinking that I have created this condition because it's mine? You know, people will complain, this or that person always pushes my buttons. Well, they're your buttons. How did you get them? What do they represent? What is the meaning behind them? Why are you so sensitive about that issue? Now, we can't necessarily figure out what we might have done in the past, but we can trust the law. I have this condition because I went after it, because I wanted it, because that's how I acted, that's how I thought, that's how I felt. I do have the right to change my mind and to approach life differently. Again, Epictetus, don't consent to be hurt, and you won't be hurt. This is a choice over which you have control. There is also the part of hope that we bring to the present. A person without hope is in a kind of despair. We must have hope, not just the realization that I can create a better life for me the next time I'm here, but I can, through hope and seeing that there is a divine fitness of all things, I can have hope in this life. It was said earlier that, we've just forgotten what was said. There's no hope for some of us. Too often people will take the present circumstances and say, well, things are exactly as they should be. Yes, because you made them that way. It isn't that nature wants to bring us war or poverty or starvation. It's that we create the conditions, and nature, as our tool and our workplace, has no choice but to do what we have demanded. So things are as they are because we are stupid and selfish and greedy, and we will pay the price. So a different kind of hope has to bloom in thinkers. Martin Luther King said, we must accept finite disappointment, but never lose infinite hope. Einstein said, learn from history, live for today, hope for tomorrow. Helen Keller, nothing can be done without hope and confidence. If you ever want, if you ever down about the conditions you're in, read about her life. She graduated from college. It's absolutely amazing when you think about it. Blind and deaf. And she graduated from college. She put forth that effort and proved herself. Amazing. Bernard Williams, and we don't know who that is, there was never a night or a problem that could defeat sunrise or hope. And Anna Deavere Smith, who's the actress and author, said, hope and optimism are different. Hope has to do not with thinking everything's going to be okay, but seeing that it's not. And then you move forward anyway. What we are after is reaching the hearts and minds of all humanity, because we are a part of that humanity. There is only one self, and we are all aspects or expressions of it. Everyone who suffers, we suffer as well. Everyone who succeeds, we succeed as well. So if we can keep that hope in front of us, that our thinking, our feeling, our behavior, our sincerity, our devotion literally touches the body of humanity, then there's no need for hope, because it would be such a blessing on the whole earth if humanity could begin to know and understand about reincarnation and karma. Your questions are invited. Yes?
Well, you used the word stupid.
Well, I hope it was kindly.
Well, I think the point is that not so much that, but as ignorant.
To ignore something, yes, yeah, that's worse.
But ignorant about their true nature and about what we're talking about. So, even when we think that way, we separate ourselves from someone else because we know that we are stupid sometimes too when we think about it, but we don't use those terms because they're not elevating. They sort of like casting us down.
Right. We certainly take the point. We've always thought that stupid was a little kind, I guess, because we find ourselves being stupid so often. I mean, it's when you know better and you go right ahead and do what you wanted to do. You prove to yourself you're stupid, but we agree with you. It's more ignorant. There's ignoring what you know, which is the stupid side of it, and then there is being ignorant of the reality of it. Yes.
A sincere devotee of one of the monotheistic religions would believe that all these laws of nature were created by a supreme being. Mm-hmm. And their hope lies in unshaken faith in that supreme being and trying to live to satisfy the laws of that being, a moral life. And now, what is the difference between the kind of hope based on faith in a supreme being who is the ruler and creator of all, and the hope that comes from a acknowledgement or understanding of reincarnation?
Well, wouldn't you think that it brings it closer to ourselves rather than some outside being, that sometimes it doesn't work out that way? We can have that undying, quote, belief that he will take care of it, but there are times when he cannot take care of every little thing that we have a problem with. And, you know, it comes to a point where you start thinking, I'm past the age of just believing. I'm past that age. I am gaining knowledge about myself and around. And it gives us, in a way, an inner dignity that we need to give to that true nature within us.
Mm-hmm. There's also several aspects of that. A person who is genuinely devoted and follows the tenets of their faith, it is implied that that very devotion will provide them opportunities to touch genuine wisdom as they go through life after life, because that kind of sincerity and devotion is rewarded by life. So there's that aspect of it. The other aspect, the one that was just mentioned, there is no God. There is no supreme being. Therefore, this turning to something that isn't even real, sooner or later, it's going to defeat your thinking and your faith and your belief, and you are going to crash. And then you'll have to build your way back up. So it is a mistaken clinging to something, and in a way prevents us from maturing as a soul.
Yep.
If a diehard materialist does not believe in karma and reincarnation at all, poo-poos it, says there's no such thing, there's only one life, will that affect their reincarnation at all?
Well, first, it doesn't matter if you deny something, if it's true. It doesn't matter. I don't believe in gravity. Fine, it's my choice, but it's a stupid choice. So a diehard materialist has a perfect right to their choice. Will it affect karma and reincarnation? Absolutely not. You can't change the law because you talk against it or you don't accept it. What it means, though, is that they cut themselves off from an experience that we all have between lives. And that's a recapitulation and a digestion of the higher hopes and dreams that we had. If they do not believe that such a thing is possible, they cannot have this heaven state dream, which is subjective. So they will, however, come back, and the laws will still apply to them. We imagine one doesn't stay a materialist for too many lives. There's too much proof. I mean, we have the sun every day. We have flowers blooming. We have love and peace between individuals. So there's too much proof that there's something else going on.
The idea of reincarnation, when we look in nature, we see things coming back. But that's no direct proof to ourselves that we come back. But by just considering that, doesn't that not develop our intuition, and these analogies then begin to have an understanding that we can relate to?
We would think so. I mean, why should we be any different than everything else around us? We see things that work in cycles. Nature's cycles are very obvious to us. And for some of us, our own cycles are so far behind that we really don't even acknowledge them, but we should. We're, shall we say, the keystone. We are, in a way, the keystone for nature, for it's how we act and interact with nature that makes the problems. And if you think about it, we physically, in this form, are made up of nature, of other kingdoms in nature. So the idea is, we are the ones that should be motivating the nature and motivating these other kingdoms by the way we balance and act. We're the turning point for them. It is, in a way, an obligation for us that for some we've waited too long, and we can look and see what our planet is going through now, because we didn't work with the idea of working with nature.
You know, one of the simple things we can prove to ourselves about cycles is to just start keeping a chart. And that chart is, you know, November 20th, woke up in a bad mood. November 21st, felt seriously depressed. And keep a record. And do that for about a month or so, and you are going to be absolutely staggered to realize that you're not having those moods or feelings. Those moods are coming to you in a seasonal cycle. Maybe it's every 6 weeks you have this, I'm in a bad mood and I don't even know why, or I am depressed and I don't know why. As you begin to realize you are the planet and those are the seasons that come to you, you finally realize, I don't have to respond to that feeling. It's not me. It's not mine. It is something I created. I can change it. And if you really want to study about that in Karmic Cycles by Mr. Judge, which is in a $2 pamphlet there with various other great articles on karma, will really educate you about how to do that. Behind you, that hand has been up a while.
There's also another overlay to that. If we propose that all life moves from one source, all consciousness is one, then we are swimming, literally, in an ocean of collectivity. And therefore, we may be registering on the lowest levels or the psychic levels what's going on with the masses, and we can still say, there it is, I sense it, and step back and say, I am not that.
Just like turning off the television. You don't have to accept all the information that's coming to you. You be selective about it. But, you know, it is funny that people will be selective about buying a car, about the clothes they wear, about the food they eat, and they're not selective about the ideas that they pick up and handle and use.
Yes?
The idea was put forth that karma is the law and reincarnation is the process. And certainly that seems to be apparent in the case of human evolution and human evolution. But couldn't reincarnation also be seen as part of a more universal law of re-embodiment? In which is seen in all the different kingdoms of nature, in which there is no individual soul.
That's why there's a different word for it. It's re-embodiment, not reincarnation.
But it's still an expression of the same idea of re-embodiment in something that's permanent in a changing form that is reusing the same materials, whether we're speaking of the universe, the solar system, planet, or human being.
And that's, there is no choice there. They're following a natural impulse, following, we want to say a preset, because within, for instance, the animal kingdom, the intelligence that's manifesting in one species will move up based on its own experience. There are some mysterious hints given in the philosophy that when that intelligence has moved up to the highest point in the animal kingdom, it cannot go to the human kingdom in this cycle. The doors are closed. But it does go elsewhere and gain some experiences. So it's very mysterious, yes.
Well, then to follow up on your point there, the reincarnation of doctrine of hope is much more universal than merely the human being.
Mm-hmm.
Does it not offer hope to lower kingdoms?
Yes.
Well,
wouldn't you say so? Yes, because let's think about that idea of consciousness. We are all aware of consciousness. We have it in the waking state, in the sleeping state, in the dreaming state. Well, how about the consciousness? Let's go to the mineral. What keeps a mineral together? What, and how do we know that anything from like a grain of sand? Yet we see that there is something, some type of knowledge, not self-consciousness like the human being has, but we see it in just from the mineral to the vegetable. The vegetable that knows to go to yield towards the sun, that also needs the rain, that is affected by individuals. There's been a lot of books out about mankind and his interconnections and what degree he can enhance or not enhance the vegetable kingdom. And we know they've got that sensitivity. And then we go to the animal kingdom. That instinctual way of knowing where to be and when to be, when to eat, when to sleep, that follows the seasons. We see intelligence in these lower kingdoms, but as stated, not self-consciousness. That's why we're the, shall we say, the point that has to move everything. We have self-consciousness. They have some sort of instinctual or sensitive. They have all these others, but not self-consciousness. So we're the helpmate. And we,
yes.
Some things, sometimes we just don't think about that.
Well, we would question, though, there has to be another word. Hope is something that an individual who also feels the opposite turns to. There's hope and despair. We don't think that's in the lower consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah.
We think there has to be another word. Re-embodiment as the doctrine of progress. We hope for progress and seem to spend more of our time wandering in defeat and despair. But we agree, it's universal as a process. Karma uses that re-embodiment all the way through, including in planets. We are taught that when last we were on a different planet, it was what is now our moon. That we are the product of evolution as it took place on the moon. You've had your hand up several times.
Well, we've always been impressed by the simplicity of explanations given in our youth about Moses. Go down in Egypt land and tell Pharaoh to let my people go. Well, we know Moses contracted leprosy. Oh, the story
I didn't know
what
that.
He went through and the crossing of the Red Sea. Well, as children, we adhere to those, Sunday school and so forth, but at this particular point in life, we have matured. And the purpose of ULT can be shown in leading us out of our infantile understanding to a more adult responsibility. It's about us and what we have to do. And the karma and reincarnation is the blueprint. Faith then takes place and you begin.
But in spite of having to step aside from our infantile thinking and independence, to remain childlike at the same time is appropriate. There's a faith and a beauty and a love and an innocence in the mind of a child. But you know, if we read about Moses, and seriously, we didn't know anything about leprosy. You'll have to tell us where that is. But if you read the story of Exodus, how you can then turn to the supposed God and even care to approach in thought and feeling, because every time the Pharaoh would reflect upon, should I do this? Should I let Moses and his people go? And he would decide, yes, yes, I will do this. It is right. It says right in the Bible, and God changed his mind. What kind of a God is that? And you begin to realize that what is really meant, and almost every time you read Lord or God in the Bible, is law. Law changed his mind. His own karma forced him to go against the better side of his own nature. So that's the very thing that we have to look for. And that knowledge, knowing that there is that division in our nature, we are a part of the higher working through the lower. So we have to figure out where we stand on all the choices we make. Not in a beat yourself up way, but in an educate yourself way and taking your time. It is a slow process.
You know, we were just thinking, think about the child, a young child, toddlers, that can barely make a whole sentence. They know when something's right and when something's wrong. They know that whole principle of justice, of balance, of harmony. They'll say it's not fair, it's not right. And these are uneducated in a way in this physical form, but instinctually there's something within them that knows that's not fair. He shouldn't be able to do that. Why can't we do this? Or it's not right. Where does that come from? He hasn't even learned how to finish a full sentence. But instinctually, there are things that have been brought forth in this physical form, in this personality, of knowledge already gained in other lifetimes, and it's innate within them. Children, we should question that.
Yes.
We spoke of the different kingdoms, animal and
vegetable.
But what of nations? Mm-hmm. Do they reincarnate or re-embody? Is there any proof that nations or societies come back?
One of the principles in theosophy of
Rome.
Well, yes, but that's a specific that. Groups come together and work their way together. In other words, we were in Atlantis, we were in Egypt, we were in Greece, we have been in various cultures, and we are reflecting in the United States, Rome. It's seen in our Senate, it's seen in our roads, it's seen in our devotions in various ways, including all of the sports. What do you call that?
The Olympics.
Well, that's really Greek.
Spectacles.
Yes, spectacles. This spectacle of sports, instead of becoming athletic yourself, just going and watching these massive things. We are very much reflecting what happened and what thinking and feeling created Rome. We have that now. So yes, nations do. Whether we stay in a nation or not, and whether we stay in it to help improve it, or we stay in it because it satisfies us, is up to us. It is our choices that move us, not just through life, but through national identification. Yes.
Well, I can't give Rome all the credit. We see a lot of Egypt about us. I mean, the beauty industry and building these monuments into the sky, and even having pyramids on top of
specialization.
Specialization.
Yes.
And so we're a melting pot.
Well, we think, though, in a timeline frame, Egypt, then Rome, than the United States. So, well, yes, there's many, many reflections there. We are at Atlantis as well. Some of the things that we read in the Secret Doctrine show us that we're just repeating ourselves. It is all in what we want. And we see what we want collectively in the advertising, in the just the way we celebrate holidays, instead of making them as they were spiritual reflections, it's all buying, buying, buying. We would imagine by next year that Black Friday will start after Easter. You know, it's just moving backwards all the time. Yes.
When you made the statement, you said never forget history, live for today, and hope for tomorrow. When you look back at history, for looking at history, if you go through a problem now in the present, should you deal with the problem according to what you're going through history, deal with the problem, or just let the movie play and let it go through?
Well, that's a difficult question. What can you remember? The point is that most of us are not stupid. We are deaf, dumb, and blind to our own history. We don't know what we've done in past lives. The only way we can know is what is happening to me right now. I am being, challenged by this. I am being criticized for this, and I don't know what to do. To sit down and reflect, I am a spiritual being. As a spiritual being, I have resources I've never even dreamt of. If I spend more time looking for them through reading devotional books, through questioning my own motives, I will come to a different kind of awareness. The history of what nations and individuals have done, yes, that's important, but I don't have my history in front of me. I can only take the best movement I can.
Now, I was pertaining to individual or individuals on a small scale. You know, if you mean
the history in this life, how they work together.
If somebody's doing something to you wrong and have done something and it's overbearing and you holding it in and it stops you from
taking better steps, yes.
It stops you from moving forward like you're supposed to, should you deal with the problem to release the anxiety and the stress from what has happened.
Yes,
to you.
But you should deal with the problem inside yourself.
Right.
Because
not on the outside.
You
right.
are the problem in how you're receiving
right.
something. Isn't the old expression, it takes two to quarrel?
Mm-hmm. Tango.
Kind of?
Tango.
Oh, no.
A lot of times it doesn't. Sometimes you can be singled out to be messed with for no apparent reason at all.
That's right. The important stress there is apparent. There's no apparent reason life is dumping all of this on me. However, there is a reason, and I have to trust that. So it's me I have to fix and change, not life or the other people around me.
Right.
It's me.
Right.
And your attitude of mind.
Mind, right.
That's basically a good tie-in, because you can use your mind in a lower way, and you can use your mind in a higher way.
Yes.
So it's the attitude of mind that's more important than the actual doing, because that's going to be the motivator to have whatever you're going to be doing.
Just to follow through on that, because that's brilliant, because we don't even realize it. We ponder something, and then put it aside. No, we don't. That's not the way we work. As thinkers, sooner or later, we're going to say that, or we're going to do it, or we're going to act on it. We poison our own lives by not realizing that the things we churn in our mind and then think we've let go are there and waiting. It was what was said about the seeds. You know, there's that wonderful old Mexican proverb. They thought they were burying us. They forgot we were seeds.
Mm.
So all the thoughts and feelings you have are ripe seeds, and they will, without your permission, because you are carrying them and that's all the permission they need, they will bloom in some way on some day.
Way
in the back.
Science and medicine now confirms that physically we're electromagnetic dynamos. So as we carry seeds or baggage or whatever you want to call that, scarring, we generate energy around those sensations and ideas and habits, and therefore we magnetize life so that it brings us more of the same.
Hmm. Perfectly said. And it's the reason sometimes we approach somebody and we don't even want to talk to them. And it's because they don't even realize how they have magnetized themselves. And they bring to themselves things that are like. So you're in a bad mood and people around you do things that equate to a bad mood. We're fascinating if we would just begin to study the laws and principles of what's going on in our own natures, in our own lives. I mean, just take one day to really sit and reflect on the human body. Cut yourself, and what happens? The most incredible forces happen, rush to that area to protect it, to close it in its own way if it's possible. Think about, okay, I'm going to sit and have lunch. Then what? How does lunch turn into bone and tissue and skin and hair and teeth? What is going on? The most brilliant computer in the world is right here. And it manufactures everything that it needs unless we interfere with it through mood and through taking in things that are toxic for us. And one of the worst things that is toxic for us, as was mentioned earlier, is the sense of separateness. If you hold that you are separate, you are totally mistaken, and you're twisting your consciousness, because you are one with all that lives, visible or invisible. You had your hand?
Well, yeah, it was a while ago, but...
no, wait, we called on you. It's hard to see you.
We do remember. The expression is it takes two to tango, but that's an aside, because it's a dance. Life is a dance. It's like it's a choreography, in a sense. But we need to learn how to respond without just reacting. That's the problem, is that most of us, we think, in this world, react often. If somebody does hit a nerve, if they hit a nerve, it's like we always have an answer ready, but it's always the wrong thing to say. So we need to learn how to just take time and take a breath and respond in the most compassionate way that we can.
And this is a good idea. How many of us have gone to some place, and for the moment we walked into that room, we had either chills or something going up and down our body, or we're drawn over to this group of people, and then we're not drawn to this group because it's almost like a wall's been put up. We can sense these things, but we just let them pass through us. But we can't. We are affected by places, because even this room holds inner vibrations from years and years and years ago. And yet, a sensitive person can feel it. People go someplace and they said, I had the most wonderful time. Other people have gone to certain things and said, I couldn't wait to get out of there. It's like we have atmospheres all around us that are holding things in. And we can be affected by that at times, of wanting to either get away from an area or wanting to get closer to this group of people because we feel like we're drawn to them. We never question these things, but we've all had those experiences, whether negative or positive.
On the comment you made that, you know, when you feel that somebody has touched a nerve, you should make this effort to kind of reverse what you were going to do and think and feel. And that is often a mistake, because we can't make progress in a leap. You don't leap up a mountain. You climb and you struggle on your way up. So instead of making that attempt, say nothing. Just think about what you would have said and then try to think, why? Why do I feel that way when I know it's against my own nature? Now, our time is just about up. We wanted to close with a quote from HPB. This law, karma, she's speaking of, whether conscious or unconscious, predestines nothing and no one. It exists from and in eternity, truly, for it is eternity itself. And as such, since no act can be co-equal with eternity, it cannot be said to act, for it is action itself. Karma creates nothing, nor does it design. It is man who plans and creates causes, and karmic law adjusts the effects, which adjustment is not an act, but universal harmony, tending ever to resume its original position. And our position should be one of hope. Meeting is adjourned.
Can you reach it? Pull it.
Oh, pull it?